Guns, Germs, and Steel by Jared Diamond, Cassette 4, Side 1. By all these means, ancient farmers who didn't understand plant reproductive biology still ended up with useful crops that bred true and were worth replanting, instead of initially promising mutants whose worthless progeny were consigned to oblivion. Thus, farmers selected from among individual plants on the basis not only of perceptible qualities like size and taste, but also of invisible features like seed dispersal mechanisms, germination inhibition, and reproductive biology. As a result, different plants became selected for quite different or even opposite features. Some plants, like sunflowers, were selected for much bigger seeds, while others, like bananas, were selected for tiny or even non-existent seeds. Lettuce was selected for luxuriant leaves at the expense of seeds or fruit, wheat and sunflowers for seeds at the expense of leaves, and squash for fruit at the expense of leaves. Especially instructive are cases in which a single wild plant species was variously selected for different purposes and thereby gave rise to quite different looking crops. Beets, grown already in Babylonian times for their leaves, like the modern beet varieties called chards, were then developed for their edible roots, and finally, in the 18th century, for their sugar content, sugar beets. Ancestral cabbage plants, possibly grown originally for their oily seeds, underwent even greater diversification as they became variously selected for leaves. Modern cabbage and kale, stems, kohlrabi, buds, Brussels sprouts, or flower shoots, cauliflower and broccoli. So far, we have been discussing transformations of wild plants into crops as a result of selection by farmers, consciously or unconsciously. That is, farmers initially selected seeds of certain wild plant individuals to bring into their gardens and then chose certain progeny seeds each year to grow in the next year's garden. But much of the transformation was also affected as a result of plants selecting themselves. Darwin's phrase natural selection refers to certain individuals of a species surviving better and or reproducing more successfully than competing individuals of the same species under natural conditions. In effect, the natural processes of differential survival and reproduction do the selecting. If the conditions change, different types of individuals may now survive or reproduce better and become naturally selected, with the result that the population undergoes evolutionary change. A classic example is the development of industrial melanism in British moths. Darker moth individuals became relatively commoner than paler individuals as the environment became dirtier during the 19th century, because dark moths, resting on a dark, dirty tree, were more likely than contrasting pale moths to escape the attention of predators. Much as the Industrial Revolution changed the environment for moths, farming changed the environment for plants. A tilled, fertilized, watered, weeded garden provides growing conditions very different from those on a dry, unfertilized hillside. Many changes of plants under domestication resulted from such changes in conditions and hence in the favored types of individuals. For example, when a farmer sows seeds densely in a garden, there is intense competition among the seeds. Big seeds that can take advantage of the good conditions to grow quickly will now be favored over small seeds that were previously favored on dry, unfertilized hillsides where seeds were sparser and competition less intense. Such increased competition among plants themselves made a major contribution to larger seed size and to many other changes developing during the transformation of wild plants into ancient crops. What accounts for the great differences among plants in ease of domestication, such that some species were domesticated long ago and others not until the Middle Ages, whereas still other wild plants have proved immune to all our activities? We can deduce many of the answers by examining the well-established sequence in which various crops developed in Southwest Asia's Fertile Crescent. It turns out that the earliest Fertile Crescent crops, such as the wheat and barley and peas domesticated around 10,000 years ago, arose from wild ancestors offering many advantages. They were already edible and gave high yields in the wild. They were easily grown, merely by being sown or planted. They grew quickly and could be harvested within a few months of sowing, a big advantage for incipient farmers still on the borderline between nomadic hunters and settled villagers. They could be readily stored, unlike many later crops, such as strawberries and lettuce. They were mostly self-pollinating. That is, the crop varieties could pollinate themselves and pass on their own desirable genes unchanged, instead of having to hybridize with other varieties less useful to humans. Finally, their wild ancestors required very little genetic change to be converted into crops. For instance, in wheat, just the mutations for non-shattering stalks and uniform quick germination. A next stage of crop development included the first fruit and nut trees, domesticated around 4000 BC. They comprised olives, figs, dates, pomegranates, and grapes. Compared with cereals and legumes, they had the drawback of not starting to yield food until at least 3 years after planting, and not reaching full production until after as much as a decade. Thus, growing these crops was possible only for people already fully committed to the settled village life. However, these early fruit and nut trees were still the easiest such crops to cultivate. Unlike later tree domesticates, they could be grown directly by being planted as cuttings or even seeds. Cuttings have the advantage that once ancient farmers had found or developed a productive tree, they could be sure that all its descendants would remain identical to it. A third stage involved fruit trees that proved much harder to cultivate, including apples, pears, plums, and cherries. These trees cannot be grown from cuttings. It's also a waste of effort to grow them from seed, since the offspring, even of an outstanding individual tree of those species, are highly variable and mostly yield worthless fruit. Instead, those trees must be grown by the difficult technique of grafting, developed in China long after the beginnings of agriculture. Not only is grafting hard work, even once you know the principle, but the principle itself could have been discovered only through conscious experimentation. The invention of grafting was hardly just a matter of some nomad relieving herself at a latrine and returning later to be pleasantly surprised by the resulting crop of fine fruit. Many of these late-stage fruit trees posed a further problem in that their wild progenitors were the opposite of self-pollinating. They had to be cross-pollinated by another plant belonging to a genetically different variety of their species. Hence, early farmers either had to find mutant trees not requiring cross-pollination, or had consciously to plant genetically different varieties, or else male and female individuals nearby in the same orchard. All those problems delayed the domestication of apples, pears, plums, and cherries until around classical times. At about the same time, though, another group of late domesticates arose with much less effort, as wild plants that established themselves initially as weeds in fields of intentionally cultivated crops. Crops starting out as weeds included rye and oats, turnips and radishes, beets and leeks, and lettuce. Although the detailed sequence that I've just described applies to the Fertile Crescent, partly similar sequences also appeared elsewhere in the world. In particular, the Fertile Crescent's wheat and barley exemplify the class of crops termed cereals or grains, members of the grass family, while Fertile Crescent peas and lentils exemplify pulses, members of the legume family, which includes beans. Cereal crops have the virtues of being fast-growing, high in carbohydrates, and yielding up to a ton of edible food per hectare cultivated. As a result, cereals today account for over half of all calories consumed by humans and include five of the modern world's 12 leading crops: wheat, corn, rice, barley, and sorghum. Many cereal crops are low in protein, but that deficit is made up by pulses, which are often 25% protein, 38% in the case of soybeans. Cereals and pulses together thus provide many of the ingredients of a balanced diet. The domestication of local cereal-pulse combinations launched food production in many areas. The most familiar examples are the combination of wheat and barley with peas and lentils in the Fertile Crescent, the combination of corn with several bean species in Mesoamerica, and the combination of rice and millets with soybeans and other beans in China. Less well known are Africa's combination of sorghum, African rice, and pearl millet with cowpeas and ground nuts, and the Andes combination of the non-cereal grain quinoa with several bean species. The Fertile Crescent's early domestication of flax for fiber was paralleled elsewhere. Hemp, four cotton species, yucca, and agave, variously furnished fiber for rope and woven clothing in China, Mesoamerica, India, Ethiopia, Sub-Saharan Africa, and South America, supplemented in several of those areas by wool from domestic animals. Of the centers of early food production, only the eastern United States and New Guinea remained without a fiber crop. Alongside these parallels, there were also some major differences in food production systems around the world. One is that agriculture in much of the Old World came to involve broadcast seeding and monoculture fields, and eventually plowing. That is, seeds were sown by being thrown in handfuls, resulting in a whole field devoted to a single crop. Once cows, horses, and other large mammals were domesticated, they were hitched to plows and fields were tilled by animal power. In the New World, however, no animal was ever domesticated that could be hitched to a plow. Instead, fields were always tilled by handheld sticks or hoes, and seeds were planted individually by hand and not scattered as whole handfuls. Most New World fields thus came to be mixed gardens of many crops planted together rather than monoculture. Another major difference among agricultural systems involved the main sources of calories and carbohydrates. As we have seen, these were cereals in many areas. In other areas, though, that role of cereals was taken over or shared by roots and tubers, which were of negligible importance in the ancient Fertile Crescent and China. Manioc, alias cassava, and sweet potato became staples in tropical South America, potato and oca in the Andes, African yams in Africa, and Indo-Pacific yams and taro in Southeast Asia and New Guinea. Tree crops, notably bananas and breadfruit, also furnished carbohydrate-rich staples in Southeast Asia and New Guinea. Thus, by Roman times, almost all of today's leading crops were being cultivated somewhere in the world. Just as we shall see for domestic animals too, Chapter 9, ancient hunter-gatherers were intimately familiar with local wild plants, and ancient farmers evidently discovered and domesticated almost all of those worth domesticating. Of course, medieval monks did begin to cultivate strawberries and raspberries, and modern plant breeders are still improving ancient crops and have added new minor crops, notably some berries like blueberries, cranberries, and kiwi fruit, and nuts, macadamias, pecans, and cashews. But these few modern additions have remained of modest importance compared with ancient staples like wheat, corn, and rice. Still, our list of triumphs lacks many wild plants that, despite their value as food, we never succeeded in domesticating. Notable among these failures of ours are oak trees, whose acorns were a staple food of Native Americans in California and the eastern United States, as well as a fallback food for European peasants in famine times of crop failure. Acorns are nutritionally valuable, being rich in starch and oil. Like many otherwise edible wild foods, most acorns do contain bitter tannins, but acorn lovers learn to deal with tannins in the same way that they dealt with bitter chemicals in almonds and other plants, either by grinding and leaching the acorns to remove the tannins, or by harvesting acorns from the occasional mutant individual oak tree, low in tannins. Why have we failed to domesticate such a prized food source as acorns? Why did we take so long to domesticate strawberries and raspberries? What is it about those plants that kept their domestication beyond the reach of ancient farmers capable of mastering such difficult techniques as grafting? It turns out that oak trees have three strikes against them. First, their slow growth would exhaust the patience of most farmers. Sown wheat yields a crop within a few months. A planted almond grows into a nut-bearing tree in 3 or 4 years, but a planted acorn may not become productive for a decade or more. Second, oak trees evolved to make nuts of a size and taste suitable for squirrels, which we've all seen burying, digging up, and eating acorns. Oaks grow from the occasional acorn that a squirrel forgets to dig up. With billions of squirrels each spreading hundreds of acorns every year to virtually any spot suitable for oak trees to grow, we humans didn't stand a chance of selecting oaks for the acorns that we wanted. Those same problems of slow growth and fast squirrels probably also explain why beech and hickory trees, heavily exploited as wild trees for their nuts by Europeans and Native Americans, respectively, were also not domesticated. Finally, perhaps the most important difference between almonds and acorns is that bitterness is controlled by a single dominant gene in almonds, but appears to be controlled by many genes in oaks. If ancient farmers planted almonds or acorns from the occasional non-bitter mutant tree, the laws of genetics dictate that half of the nuts from the resulting tree growing up would also be non-bitter in the case of almonds, but almost all would still be bitter in the case of oaks. That alone would kill the enthusiasm of any would-be acorn farmer who had defeated the squirrels and remained patient. As for strawberries and raspberries, we had similar trouble competing with thrushes and other berry-loving birds. Yes, the Romans did tend wild strawberries in their gardens, but with billions of European thrushes defecating wild strawberry seeds in every possible place, including Roman gardens, strawberries remained the little berries that thrushes wanted, not the big berries that humans wanted. Only with the recent development of protective nets and greenhouses were we finally able to defeat the thrushes and to redesign strawberries and raspberries according to our own standards. We've thus seen that the difference between gigantic supermarket strawberries and tiny wild ones is just one example of the various features distinguishing cultivated plants from their wild ancestors. Those differences arose initially from natural variation among the wild plants themselves. Some of it, such as the variation in berry size or in nut bitterness, would have been readily noticed by ancient farmers. Other variations, such as that in seed dispersal mechanisms or seed dormancy, would have gone unrecognized by humans before the rise of modern botany. But whether or not the selection of wild edible plants by ancient hikers relied on conscious or unconscious criteria, the resulting evolution of wild plants into crops was at first an unconscious process. It followed inevitably from our selecting among wild plant individuals and from competition among plant individuals in gardens favoring individuals different from those favored in the wild. That's why Darwin, in his great book on the origin of species, didn't start with an account of natural selection. His first chapter is instead a lengthy account of how our domesticated plants and animals arose through artificial selection by humans. Rather than discussing the Galapagos Island birds that we usually associate with him, Darwin began by discussing how farmers developed varieties of gooseberries. He wrote, "I have seen great surprise expressed in horticultural works at the wonderful skill of gardeners in having produced such splendid results from such poor materials. But the art has been simple, and as far as the final result is concerned, has been followed almost unconsciously. It has consisted in always cultivating the best known variety, sowing its seeds, and, when a slightly better variety chanced to appear, selecting it, and so onwards." End quote. Those principles of crop development by artificial selection still serve as our most understandable model of the origin of species by natural selection. Chapter 8, Apples or Indians. We have just seen how peoples of some regions began to cultivate wild plant species, a step with momentous, unforeseen consequences for their lifestyle and their descendants' place in history. Let us now return to our questions. Why did agriculture never arise independently in some fertile and highly suitable areas, such as California, Europe, temperate Australia, and sub-equatorial Africa? Why, among the areas where agriculture did arise independently, did it develop much earlier in some than in others? Two contrasting explanations suggest themselves: problems with the local people, or problems with the locally available wild plants. On the one hand, perhaps almost any well-watered temperate or tropical area of the globe offers enough species of wild plants suitable for domestication. In that case, the explanation for agriculture's failure to develop in some of those areas would lie with cultural characteristics of their peoples. On the other hand, perhaps at least some humans in any large area of the globe would have been receptive to the experimentation that led to domestication. Only the lack of suitable wild plants might then explain why food production did not evolve in some areas. As we shall see in the next chapter, the corresponding problem for domestication of big wild mammals proves easier to solve, because there are many fewer species of them than of plants. The world holds only about 148 species of large wild mammalian terrestrial herbivores or omnivores, the large mammals that could be considered candidates for domestication. Only a modest number of factors determines whether a mammal is suitable for domestication. It's thus straightforward to review a region's big mammals and to test whether the lack of mammal domestication in some regions was due to the unavailability of suitable wild species rather than to local peoples. That approach would be much more difficult to apply to plants because of the sheer number, 200,000, of species of wild flowering plants, the plants that dominate vegetation on the land and that have furnished almost all of our crops. We can't possibly hope to examine all the wild plant species of even a circumscribed area like California and to assess how many of them would have been domesticable. But we shall now see how to get around that problem. When one hears that there are so many species of flowering plants, one's first reaction might be as follows. Surely, with all those wild plant species on Earth, any area with a sufficiently benign climate must have had more than enough species to provide plenty of candidates for crop development. But then reflect that the vast majority of wild plants are unsuitable for obvious reasons. They are woody, they produce no edible fruit, and their leaves and roots are also inedible. Of the 200,000 wild plant species, only a few thousand are eaten by humans, and just a few hundred of these have been more or less domesticated. Even of these several hundred crops, most provide minor supplements to our diet and would not by themselves have sufficed to support the rise of civilizations. A mere dozen species account for over 80% of the modern world's annual tonnage of all crops. Those dozen blockbusters are the cereals wheat, corn, rice, barley, and sorghum, the pulse soybean, the roots or tubers, potato, manioc, and sweet potato, the sugar sources, sugarcane and sugar beet, and the fruit banana. Cereal crops alone now account for more than half of the calories consumed by the world's human populations. With so few major crops in the world, all of them domesticated thousands of years ago, it's less surprising that many areas of the world had no wild native plants at all of outstanding potential. Our failure to domesticate even a single major new food plant in modern times suggests that ancient peoples really may have explored virtually all useful wild plants and domesticated all the ones worth domesticating. Yet some of the world's failures to domesticate wild plants remain hard to explain. The most flagrant cases concern plants that were domesticated in one area, but not in another. We can thus be sure that it was indeed possible to develop the wild plant into a useful crop, and we have to ask why that wild species was not domesticated in certain areas. A typical puzzling example comes from Africa. The important cereal sorghum was domesticated in Africa's Sahel zone, just south of the Sahara. It also occurs as a wild plant as far south as southern Africa, yet neither it nor any other plant was cultivated in southern Africa until the arrival of the whole crop package that Bantu farmers brought from Africa north of the equator 2,000 years ago. Why did the native peoples of southern Africa not domesticate sorghum for themselves? Equally puzzling is the failure of people to domesticate flax in its wild range in Western Europe and North Africa, or einkorn wheat in its wild range in the southern Balkans. Since these two plants were among the first eight crops of the Fertile Crescent, they were presumably among the most readily domesticated of all wild plants. They were adopted for cultivation in those areas of their wild range outside the Fertile Crescent as soon as they arrived with the whole package of food production from the Fertile Crescent. Why, then, had peoples of those outlying areas not already begun to grow them out of their own accord? Similarly, the four earliest domesticated fruits of the Fertile Crescent all had wild ranges stretching far beyond the eastern Mediterranean, where they appear to have been first domesticated. The olive, grape, and fig occurred west to Italy and Spain and northwest Africa, while the date palm extended to all of North Africa and Arabia. These four were evidently among the easiest to domesticate of all wild fruits. Why did peoples outside the Fertile Crescent fail to domesticate them and begin to grow them only when they had already been domesticated in the eastern Mediterranean and arrived thence as crops? Other striking examples involve wild species that were not domesticated in areas where food production never arose spontaneously, even though those wild species had close relatives domesticated elsewhere. For example, the olive Olea europaea was domesticated in the eastern Mediterranean. There are about 40 other species of olives in tropical and southern Africa, southern Asia, and eastern Australia, some of them closely related to Olea europaea, but none of them was ever domesticated. Similarly, While a wild apple species and a wild grape species were domesticated in Eurasia, there are many related wild apple and grape species in North America, some of which have in modern times been hybridized with the crops derived from their wild Eurasian counterparts in order to improve those crops. Why then didn't Native Americans domesticate those apparently useful apples and grapes themselves? One can go on and on with such examples, but there is a fatal flaw in this reasoning. Plant domestication is not a matter of hunter-gatherers domesticating a single plant and otherwise carrying on unchanged with their nomadic lifestyle. Suppose that North American wild apples really would have evolved into a terrific crop if only Indian hunter-gatherers had settled down and cultivated them. But nomadic hunter-gatherers would not throw over their traditional way of life, settle in villages, and start tending apple orchards unless many other domesticable wild plants and animals were available to make a sedentary food-producing existence competitive with a hunting-gathering existence. How, in short, do we assess the potential of an entire local flora for domestication? For those Native Americans who failed to domesticate North American apples, did the problem really lie with the Indians or with the apples? In order to answer this question, we shall now compare three regions that lie at opposite extremes among centers of independent domestication. As we have seen, one of them, the Fertile Crescent, was perhaps the earliest center of food production in the world, and the site of origin of several of the modern world's major crops and almost all of its major domesticated animals. The other two regions, New Guinea and the eastern United States, did domesticate local crops, but these crops were very few in variety. Only one of them gained worldwide importance, and the resulting food package failed to support extensive development of human technology and political organization as in the Fertile Crescent. In the light of this comparison, we shall ask, did the flora and environment of the Fertile Crescent have clear advantages over those of New Guinea and the eastern United States? One of the central facts of human history is the early importance of the part of Southwest Asia, known as the Fertile Crescent because of the crescent-like shape of its uplands. That area appears to have been the earliest site for a whole string of developments, including cities, writing, empires, and what we term, for better or worse, civilization. All those developments sprang in turn from the dense human populations, stored food surpluses, and feeding of non-farming specialists made possible by the rise of food production in the form of crop cultivation and animal husbandry. Food production was the first of those major innovations to appear in the Fertile Crescent. Hence, any attempt to understand the origins of the modern world must come to grips with the question why the Fertile Crescent's domesticated plants and animals gave it such a potent head start. Fortunately, the Fertile Crescent is by far the most intensively studied and best understood part of the globe as regards the rise of agriculture. For most crops domesticated in or near the Fertile Crescent, the wild plant ancestor has been identified. Its close relationship to the crop has been proven by genetic and chromosomal studies. Its wild geographic range is known. Its changes under domestication have been identified and are often understood at the level of single genes. Those changes can be observed in successive layers of the archaeological record, and the approximate place and time of domestication are known. I don't deny that other areas, notably China, also had advantages as early sites of domestication. But those advantages and the resulting development of crops can be specified in much more detail for the Fertile Crescent. One advantage of the Fertile Crescent is that it lies within a zone of so-called Mediterranean climate, a climate characterized by mild, wet winters and long, hot, dry summers. That climate selects for plant species able to survive the long dry season and to resume growth rapidly upon the return of the rains. Many Fertile Crescent plants, especially species of cereals and pulses, have adapted in a way that renders them useful to humans. They are annuals, meaning that the plant itself dries up and dies in the dry season. Within their mere 1 year of life, annual plants inevitably remain small herbs. Many of them instead put much of their energy into producing big seeds, which remain dormant during the dry season and are then ready to sprout when the rains come. Annual plants, therefore, waste little energy on making inedible wood or fibrous stems, like the body of trees and bushes. But many of the big seeds, notably those of the annual cereals and pulses, are edible by humans. They constitute six of the modern world's 12 major crops. In contrast, if you live near a forest and look out your window, the plant species that you see will tend to be trees and shrubs, most of whose body you cannot eat, and which put much less of their energy into edible seeds. Of course, some forest trees in areas of wet climate do produce big edible seeds, but these seeds are not adapted to surviving a long dry season and hence to long storage by humans. A second advantage of the Fertile Crescent flora is that the wild ancestors of many Fertile Crescent crops were already abundant and highly productive, occurring in large stands whose value must have been obvious to hunter-gatherers. Experimental studies in which botanists have collected seeds from such natural stands of wild cereals, much as hunter-gatherers must have been doing over 10,000 years ago, show that annual harvests of up to nearly a ton of seeds per hectare can be obtained, yielding 50 kilocalories of food energy for only 1 kilocalorie of work expended. By collecting huge quantities of wild cereals in a short time when the seeds were ripe and stored the rest of the year, some hunting-gathering peoples of the Fertile Crescent had already settled down in permanent villages even before they began to cultivate plants. Since Fertile Crescent cereals were so productive in the wild, few additional changes had to be made in them under cultivation. As we discussed in the preceding chapter, the principal changes, the breakdown of the natural systems of seed dispersal and of germination inhibition, evolved automatically and quickly as soon as humans began to cultivate the seeds in fields. The wild ancestors of our wheat and barley crops look so similar to the crops themselves that the identity of the ancestor has never been in doubt. Because of this ease of domestication, big-seeded annuals were the first or among the first crops developed not only in the Fertile Crescent, but also in China and the Sahel. Contrast this quick evolution of wheat and barley with the story of corn, the leading cereal crop of the New World. Corn's probable ancestor, a wild plant known as teosinte, looks so different from corn in its seed and flower structures that even its role as ancestor has been hotly debated by botanists for a long time. Teosinte's value as food would not have impressed hunter-gatherers. It was less productive in the wild than wild wheat. It produced much less seed than did the corn eventually developed from it, and it enclosed its seeds in inedible hard coverings. For teosinte to become a useful crop, it had to undergo drastic changes in its reproductive biology, to increase greatly its investment in seeds, and to lose those rock-like coverings of its seeds. Archaeologists are still vigorously debating how many centuries or millennia of crop development in the Americas were required for ancient corn cobs to progress from a tiny size up to the size of a human thumb. But it seems clear that several thousand more years were then required for them to reach modern sizes. That contrast between the immediate virtues of wheat and barley and the difficulties posed by teosinte may have been a significant factor in the differing developments of New World and Eurasian human societies. A third advantage of the Fertile Crescent flora is that it includes a high percentage of hermaphroditic selfers, that is, plants that usually pollinate themselves, but that are occasionally cross-pollinated. Recall that most wild plants either are regularly cross-pollinated hermaphrodites or consist of separate male and female individuals that inevitably depend on another individual for pollination. Those facts of reproductive biology vexed early farmers because, as soon as they had located a productive mutant plant, its offspring would cross-breed with other plant individuals and thereby lose their inherited advantage. As a result, most crops belong to the small percentage of wild plants that either are hermaphrodites, usually pollinating themselves, or else reproduce without sex by propagating vegetatively, for example, by a root that genetically duplicates the parent plant. Thus, the high percentage of hermaphroditic selfers in the Fertile Crescent flora aided early farmers because it meant that a high percentage of the wild flora had a reproductive biology convenient for humans. Selfers were also convenient for early farmers in that they occasionally did become cross-pollinated, thereby generating new varieties among which to select. That occasional cross-pollination occurred not only between individuals of the same species, but also between related species to produce interspecific hybrids. One such hybrid among Fertile Crescent selfers, bread wheat, became the most valuable crop in the modern world. Of the first 8 significant crops to have been domesticated in the Fertile Crescent, all were Selfers. Of the three Selfer cereals, among them, Einkorn wheat, Emmer wheat, and barley, the wheats offered the additional advantage of a high protein content, 8 to 14%. In contrast, the most important cereal crops of Eastern Asia and of the New World, rice and corn, respectively, had a lower protein content that posed significant nutritional problems. Those were some of the advantages that the Fertile Crescent's flora afforded the first farmers. It included an unusually high percentage of wild plants suitable for domestication. However, the Mediterranean climate zone of the Fertile Crescent extends westward through much of southern Europe and northwestern Africa. There are also zones of similar Mediterranean climates in four other parts of the world: California, Chile, southwestern Australia, and South Africa. Yet those other Mediterranean zones not only failed to rival the Fertile Crescent as early sites of food production, they never gave rise to indigenous agriculture at all. What advantage did that particular Mediterranean zone of Western Eurasia enjoy? It turns out that it, and especially its Fertile Crescent portion, possessed at least five advantages over other Mediterranean zones. First, Western Eurasia has by far the world's largest zone of Mediterranean climate. As a result, it has a high degree of wild plant and animal species, higher than in the comparatively tiny Mediterranean zones of southwestern Australia and Chile. Second, among Mediterranean zones, Western Eurasia's experiences the greatest climatic variation from season to season and year to year. That variation favored the evolution among the flora of an especially high percentage of annual plants. The combination of these two factors, a high diversity of species and a high percentage of annuals, means that Western Eurasia's Mediterranean zone is the one with by far the highest diversity of annuals. The significance of that botanical wealth for humans is illustrated by the geographer Mark Blumler's studies of wild grass distributions. Among the world's thousands of wild grass species, Blumler tabulated the 56 with the largest seeds, the cream of nature's crop, the grass species with seeds at least 10 times heavier than the median grass species. Virtually all of them are native to Mediterranean zones or other seasonally dry environments. Furthermore, they are overwhelmingly concentrated in the Fertile Crescent or other parts of Western Eurasia's Mediterranean zone, which offered a huge selection to incipient farmers, about 32 of the world's 56 prize wild grasses. Specifically, barley and emmer wheat, the two earliest important crops of the Fertile Crescent, rank respectively 3rd and 13th in seed size among those top 56. In contrast, the Mediterranean zone of Chile offered only two of those species, California and Southern Africa just one each, and southwestern Australia none at all. That fact alone goes a long way toward explaining the course of human history. A third advantage of the Fertile Crescent's Mediterranean zone is that it provides a wide range of altitudes and topographies within a short distance. Its range of elevations from the lowest spot on Earth, the Dead Sea, to mountains of 18,000 feet near Tehran, ensures a corresponding variety of environments, hence a high diversity of the wild plants serving as potential ancestors of crops. Those mountains are in proximity to gentle lowlands with rivers, floodplains, and deserts suitable for irrigation agriculture. In contrast, the Mediterranean zones of southwestern Australia, and to a lesser degree of South Africa and Western Europe, offer a narrower range of altitudes, habitats, and topographies. The range of altitudes in the Fertile Crescent meant staggered harvest seasons. Plants at higher elevations produced seeds somewhat later than the plants at lower elevations. As a result, hunter-gatherers could move up a mountainside harvesting grain seeds as they matured, instead of being overwhelmed by a concentrated harvest season at a single altitude, where all grains matured simultaneously. When cultivation began, it was a simple matter for the first farmers to take the seeds of wild cereals growing on hillsides and dependent on unpredictable rains, and to plant those seeds in the damp valley bottoms, where they would grow reliably and be less dependent on rain. The Fertile Crescent's biological diversity over small distances contributed to a fourth advantage. Its wealth in ancestors not only of valuable crops, but also of domesticated big mammals. As we shall see, there were few or no wild mammal species suitable for domestication in the other Mediterranean zones of California, Chile, southwestern Australia, and South Africa. In contrast, four species of big mammals, the goat, sheep, pig, and cow, were domesticated very early in the Fertile Crescent, possibly earlier than any other animal except the dog anywhere else in the world. Those species remain today four of the world's five most important domesticated mammals, Chapter 9. But their wild ancestors were commonest in slightly different parts of the Fertile Crescent, with the result that the four species were domesticated in different places. Sheep possibly in the central part, goats either in the eastern part at higher elevations, the Zagros Mountains of Iran, or in the southwestern part, the Levant, pigs in the north-central part, and cows in the western part, including Anatolia. Nevertheless, even though the areas of abundance of these four wild progenitors thus differed, all four lived in sufficiently close proximity that they were readily transferred after domestication from one part of the Fertile Crescent to another, and the whole region ended up with all four species. Agriculture was launched in the Fertile Crescent by the early domestication of eight crops, termed founder crops, because they founded agriculture in the region and possibly in the world. Those eight founders were the cereals, emmer wheat, einkorn wheat, and barley, the pulses, lentil, pea, chickpea, and bitter vetch, and the fiber crop, flax. Of these eight, only two, flax and barley, range in the wild at all, widely outside the Fertile Crescent and Anatolia. Two of the founders had very small ranges in the wild, chickpeas being confined to southeastern Turkey, and emmer wheat to the Fertile Crescent itself. Thus, agriculture could arise in the Fertile Crescent from domestication of locally available wild plants, without having to wait for the arrival of crops derived from wild plants domesticated elsewhere. Conversely, two of the eight founder crops could not have been domesticated anywhere in the world except in the Fertile Crescent, since they did not occur wild elsewhere. Thanks to this availability of suitable wild mammals and plants, early peoples of the Fertile Crescent could quickly assemble a potent and balanced biological package for intensive food production. That package comprised three cereals as the main carbohydrate sources, four pulses with 20 to 25% protein, and four domestic animals as the main protein sources, supplemented by the generous protein content of wheat, and flax as a source of fiber and oil, termed linseed oil. Flax seeds are about 40% oil. Eventually, thousands of years after the beginnings of animal domestication and food production, the animals also began to be used for milk, wool, plowing, and transport. Thus, the crops and animals of the Fertile Crescent's first farmers came to meet humanity's basic economic needs: carbohydrate, protein, fat, clothing, traction, and transport. A final advantage of early food production in the Fertile Crescent is that it may have faced less competition from the hunter-gatherer lifestyle than that in some other areas, including the Western Mediterranean. Southwest Asia has few large rivers and only a short coastline, providing relatively meager aquatic resources in the form of river and coastal fish and shellfish. One of the important mammal species hunted for meat, the gazelle, originally lived in huge herds, but was overexploited by the growing human population and reduced to low numbers. Thus, the food production package quickly became superior to the hunter-gatherer package. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Please reverse or turn the cassette over now.